Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Vatican today reaffirmed its position against gays in the priesthood. The Church's Congregation for Catholic Education released its so-called instruction, although an Italian Catholic news agency leaked the document last week. The instruction says that men with deep-seated homosexual tendencies should not be ordained. But if gay men have been able to overcome those tendencies for at least 3 years, they can enter the priesthood. Joining us from Rome is Time magazine correspondent Jeff Israeli. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
How does this instruction clarify the Church's position on gay priests?
Well, some would say that it doesn't necessarily clarify it altogether. As you mentioned, it is an attempt by the Vatican to reaffirm a standing ban on gays in the priesthood. It has set out some new language trying to set out standards for what exactly constitutes a gay candidate for the priesthood with these deep-seated homosexual tendencies, etc., but does leave some room for celibate priests who may have had these tendencies in the past and have overcome them to in fact join the priesthood.
So that room there for celibate priests who may have overcome those tendencies, is that an easing of the ban?
No, I don't think it should be interpreted in any way as an easing in the ban. It's an acknowledgement that these are complicated issues, and the Church acknowledges that and did not want to put out a draconian document. But the point really is that the Vatican and Pope Benedict XVI himself felt it was important to reaffirm this ban and to discourage gay men from joining the priesthood.
What about openly gay priests who are already ordained?
No, this document does not in any way affect them. It is a document put out, as you said, by the Congregation for Catholic Education in regards to the ordination of new priests.
And it doesn't really define deep-seated, what deep-seated tendencies might mean, right?
That's correct. It will be left up to the discretion to some degree of the rectors in the seminaries and the counselors who speak to the candidates. But the 3-year window for overcoming whatever inclinations a candidate may have had in the past is a parallel with other regulations about candidates who have had some sexual activity in the past but have shown an ability to lead a celibate life.
Mm-hmm. Even heterosexuals.
Exactly.
And why would the Vatican do this now? And was there any consideration in doing this regarding the priest shortage in the United States and how an outright ban and reaffirming that ban might affect the shortage of priests here?
Well, there are obviously different interpretations. Progressives in the Church worry that reaffirming this ban on gay priests will discourage new priests from coming in. Will also might prompt some gay priests who are already in the clergy to leave the clergy. Conservatives in the Church feel that there was a gay culture within the priesthood, within seminaries, that had built up over time, and their hope is that this document will help undo that so-called gay culture and encourage more heterosexual priests who in the past may not have wanted to be in that environment.
Mm-hmm. And what has reaction been like?
Here in Rome, this has not been as much of an issue as it is back in the States. You know, I believe that the situation there in the U.S. coming after the pre-sex abuse scandal, where American Catholics are very attuned to these issues. Here in the Vatican, there hasn't been as much talk about it as there is perhaps back in the States. But as you may have noticed, this story has sort of dragged out over the past 3 months. The Vatican clearly has a problem in the beginning of this new papacy in controlling the flow of information. This is the kind of document, the kind of issue that in the past the Vatican has done very well to control and to let it out under its own terms. Something needs to be fixed in terms of the way information flows under Benedict XVI.
Well, Jeff, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jeff Israeli is a correspondent for Time magazine. He spoke to us from Rome. The U.S. Supreme Court tomorrow takes up its first abortion case in 5 years. The justices, including the newly appointed John Roberts, will hear the New Hampshire case, Ayotte versus Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. The decision in this case could radically alter the power states have in restricting access to abortion. Joining us on the line is Jack Balkin. He's a professor of constitutional law at Yale Law School. Jack, can you tell us what this case is about?
Planned Parenthood is challenging an abortion statute passed by New Hampshire. The statute requires that minors who want to get an abortion have to first notify their parents. Planned Parenthood is challenging the statute because it doesn't make any exception for cases in which, for emergency reasons, the minor's health would be endangered. The second issue is what you have to show when you go into court to get an injunction against a newly passed abortion law.
A newly passed law.
Yes.
So one that technically hasn't taken effect yet.
That's right.
So that could affect a wide variety of other abortion rulings.
A wide variety of other abortion laws passed by states that would like to regulate abortion more severely.
And that's really the crux of what could change things nationwide.
That is a highly technical question, but it turns out to be the most important question from the standpoint of the reason the court took the case and the effects of the decision.
Okay, so explain to me now, if someone wants to fight an abortion ruling, they seek an injunction and this challenges that. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Generally speaking, when you challenge a newly passed abortion law, you go into court and you ask for an injunction and a declaration that the statute's unconstitutional. In the Casey decision, which came down in 1992, the Supreme Court said, for a substantial number of women or significant number of women for whom the statute applies, it creates an undue burden for them. Then the court is authorized to enjoin the statute as unconstitutional. That appears to be what the Supreme Court said in 1992 in Casey. In this case, however, the Attorney General of New Hampshire is saying that's not the rule. The rule should be that if the statute is completely unconstitutional in all of its applications, then you can strike it down. But if it's constitutional in any of its applications, then you shouldn't be able to go immediately into court and enjoin it.
So if it has a shred of constitutionality somewhere, it should be okay?
You shouldn't be able to enjoin it immediately. Instead, people should be able to go to the court and say that the law is unconstitutional as applied to them.
And is this based on another Supreme Court ruling?
It's based upon an earlier case called Salerno, which is a case in the criminal procedure area. And the question is whether or not the rules regarding this criminal procedure decision should also apply to issues regarding abortion. Now, the Planned Parenthood argues that it doesn't apply because the Casey decision by itself told the courts how to deal with challenges to abortion regulations. And so it's just not relevant. The Salerno opinion isn't relevant. And one of the things the Supreme Court is going to try to do is figure out which rule applies. If they decide that abortion statutes can't be challenged unless they're completely, totally, and absolutely unconstitutional in all their applications, then the effect will be very important. It will mean that states can pass more restrictive abortion laws, and those laws can stay on the books for a very long period of time. People will have to go individually and challenge them and chip away at little parts of them until the unconstitutional applications are all held unconstitutional. That could take years, and it'll be very expensive. Mm-hmm. Under the rule that Planned Parenthood is arguing for, once the statute's passed, you can go into federal court and say, look, this statute poses a substantial burden to a significant number of women that it applies to, and if the court agrees, then the statute is enjoined, and it can't be used to restrict abortions for anyone else.
If it does go in favor of New Hampshire, how would potential future abortion cases be affected?
It'll be more difficult to bring challenges mm-hmm. to the cases, and the other issue that is lurking in the background is the question of under what conditions lack of a health exception makes a statute unconstitutional. Now, it turns out that the federal partial birth abortion law that was passed by Congress a while back and has been challenged in the federal courts also lacks a health exception, but that's because Congress believes that partial birth abortions are never better for a woman's health than other procedures. That is, by the way, a view that's been challenged by some people in the medical profession. If that case comes to the Supreme Court, as I expect it will, then what the court says in the Ayotte case about the requirement of health exceptions for a statute to be constitutional will probably be significantly relevant to the decision on the partial birth abortion statute.
Have there been challenges to the health exemptions in the past, and what have courts ruled on them?
Well, there was a previous case involving partial birth abortion that came out of Nebraska in 2000. That was the last big abortion case before Ayotte. And in that case, the Supreme Court held, in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court held that Nebraska's failure to allow this procedure where it was medically indicated for the small class of cases where it was the safest approach for women who needed abortions, that was unconstitutional. That is to say, the Supreme Court said that the health of the woman was very important to protect in the context of her right to an abortion, and that the state, in effect, couldn't require women to adopt a less safe method of abortion when a more safe method was available. Now, that suggests that if that rule still is good, it still applies, that would be a problem for New Hampshire's statute.
And what about the different Supreme Court? How might that affect what happens here?
Well, the Supreme Court is going to have at least one new member, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, right, and it's likely to have a second new member, Sam Alito. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen with the Alito hearings, but let's for the moment assume that Alito is confirmed. Then the decision in this case is probably going to turn on Justice Kennedy's vote. Four of the justices are likely to hold that the Casey standard for challenging abortion laws is the right standard, not the Salerno standard, and four of them are likely to hold that the absence of a health exception makes the statute unconstitutional as to minors who have serious health emergencies when they seek an abortion. That means that in order to get a fifth vote, you're going to have to get it from the new justices or from the other ones who are already on the court. And of those, the most likely to join the four liberal justices would be Justice Kennedy. So his vote is probably going to decide this case. And indeed, he is the new swing justice on the Supreme Court. His views on a whole bunch of issues ranging from abortion to affirmative action to equality issues to free speech issues will probably be the deciding factor in closely contested 5-4 cases.
Jeff Balkin is a professor of constitutional law at Yale University Law School. Coming up, we talk with Boston Globe reporter Rick Klein about what's known about Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito's views on abortion, in particular his writing on a 1985 job application about whether there's a constitutional right to an abortion, and his dissent in the 1991 case of Casey versus Planned Parenthood. Also, some 400 pages of Alito's writings were released yesterday. We hear what they may reveal about his philosophy regarding law enforcement, privacy, and capital punishment. Judge Alito's Senate questionnaire, the same questionnaire that caused problems for Harriet Myers, is expected to be turned in later today. There's more ahead. Stay with us here and now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation about abortion and the Supreme Court, we're taking a look at how Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito might rule on abortion-related cases if he's confirmed next year. Many liberals say Alito will restrict access to abortion, but conservatives are not so sure. 400 pages of documents released yesterday reveal some of Alito's past writings when he was a lawyer in the Reagan administration. We'll learn more about Alito's thinking today when he hands in his responses to a Senate questionnaire. Joining us on the line from Washington is reporter Rick Klein of the Boston Globe. Welcome, Rick.
Hi.
First to abortion. Was the first abortion case in 5 years to go before the high court this week. The question is, do people think that Alito will vote to overturn Roe versus Wade, the 1973 Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion?
Well, the short answer is nobody knows for sure, and we're not going to know in all likelihood, even by the end of his nomination hearings in January. He's not going to answer that question directly, and he hasn't addressed it directly in any of his writings. The most interesting and most intriguing clue is a 1985 job application for a job in the Reagan Justice Department, where he said he was proud of his work, where he argued that there is no constitutional right to abortion. Read very strictly, and assuming that's still his view 20 years later, that would suggest that he would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade, which did establish that constitutional right to abortion. However, in his meeting with senators, he has gone out of his way to stress the value of precedent. The fact that, the Roe decision has been reaffirmed some 38 times gives it some extra weight, he has suggested. So that would be a clue in the other direction. And we don't know the answer, and I don't think we're going to ever know it.
So there are mixed decisions. We know, of course, his 90-year-old mother said her Catholic son, of course, is against abortion. Overall, though, when he was an appellate court judge in Pennsylvania, what did we also get a mixed review from his rulings there?
We sure did. The most famous case was the case of Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1991, which was a landmark Supreme Court decision just 2 years later than that. And in that case, Judge Alito dissented, and he said that the state of Pennsylvania did have a right to require married women to notify their husbands before getting abortions. The Supreme Court later threw that out. So the fact that he dissented in that famous opinion is viewed by abortion rights supporters as a signal that he would vote to limit abortion rights. However, he had three other decisions of note where he struck down state laws that would have limited access to abortion, including a partial birth ban, said that was not constitutional. But the key thing to remember here is that when he's on the federal appellate court, he is working under the rubric of Supreme Court precedents. When he's on the Supreme Court, he has a chance to change those precedents and actually shape the law of the land.
So how much of an indication are these appellate court writings then, really, and how much weight are they put on during his confirmation hearings as to how he might, in fact, rule as a Supreme Court justice?
He's going to be asked very, very extensively about all the rulings, and I think particularly the Casey ruling. But I think in a lot of these cases, and I think we saw this with Chief Justice Roberts' nomination as well, the senators end up seeing what they want to see in the nominee, because there's enough clues in either direction to suggest that, yes, this person would overturn Roe v. Wade. No, this person would never overturn Roe v. Wade. So, you know, I think his performance and his demeanor during the hearings are going to matter quite a bit. What else there is in terms of his writings on abortion, this cache of papers yesterday from the Justice Department didn't really shed any light on abortion. I don't think the word abortion, at least not in a substantive way, was mentioned anywhere in those papers.
Mm-hmm. But the papers yesterday did shed light on a couple of other things. One, that when he advised the Reagan administration that those who are not U.S. citizens do not have constitutional protections. Do you think that was a major sort of indicator of how Samuel Alito might go in the future there?
To me, the most interesting part about that is that it was buried in a footnote of a memo, and it was almost an aside. That is very much in line with what the Bush administration has said now with regard to the detainment of enemy combatants in Guantanamo Bay and some other sites. But the fact that he went out of his way to make that point when it wasn't directly relevant to the matter at hand suggests that he's something of a more strongly held belief. But again, he's working now for a client. His client was the Reagan administration, and that was the official Reagan administration policy at the time. So it's hard to say whether this was, in fact, his personal legal opinion or if this was just him being a good worker for his client.
Yeah. And what about his advice against a ban on capital punishment for minors?
That was interesting. There was a United Nations Convention on the Rights of Children, and included in that proposal was a blanket ban on capital punishment for minors. And he said, wait a second, we as the Reagan administration should urge that this be removed because we have a number of states currently, and this was in 1987, I believe, currently who do allow capital punishment for some minors. In fact, that was the law of the land until just this March when the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to ban all capital punishment of minors. So he was saying we should be careful as the Reagan administration before we sign off on something like this.
And how about that Senate questionnaire that he's supposed to hand in today? Why has it taken him so long to do it?
Well, it may be a lesson from Harriet Myers, who sent hers back relatively quickly and then was roundly criticized by senators for basically being graded and incomplete on it because of some holes in it, some areas where she seemed to leave things out, some areas where she even misstated slightly constitutional law. So it may be just the kind of abundance of caution. I think part of it has to do with the calendar as well, because last week was Thanksgiving. Things slowed up in Washington, as it does in much of the country. And I think there's also, there has been throughout these processes an attempt, I think, by the White House to
to get the news cycle as much in their favor as possible and to put things out at the time that they think it can have the maximum benefit. So I think that may be a factor as well.
Do you think that that questionnaire will shed more light, or do you think we'll still have sort of a mixed review here of Samuel Alito's ratings?
I think we're going to end up with a mixed review throughout this process. I mean, it's certainly going to be proofread by many, many people within the Bush administration, and many smart lawyers are going to look at this to make sure that they're not giving away too much, so to speak. But I think, yeah, I think it is inevitable that we're going to enter this process and finish this process not knowing entirely how Judge Alito would rule as a justice. And some would argue that that's a good thing. You shouldn't get any kind of previews as to how a judge rules, that you should know that he'd be fair and unbiased, and that should be enough, because that could come up, and he would be potentially compromising his ability to be impartial on that case later.
Rick Klein reports for the Boston Globe in Washington. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the president delivers a major speech on Iraq. We'll get reaction from across the country. Also, we hear from the captain of a quadriplegic rugby team about a game he calls Murder Ball. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. A new report says the process by which the United States is trying to cut off financing to terrorist agencies is broken. The Government Accountability Office report says the Bush administration is failing to stop the supply of money going to terrorist groups, even though that has been a key White House goal since the September 11th attacks. Among other things, the report blames bureaucratic infighting and leadership problems. Joining us on the line is Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley, who requested the report. Senator, what strikes you in this report?
Well, I think you summarized it very well. To emphasize, I would say that we have three government agencies that aren't working together to get the job done. Each is probably protecting their own turf. You know that that's a disease there in Washington, D.C. among bureaucrats. We have instances in which, for instance, the State Department would not issue visas to go to one of these priority countries for the Treasury Department officials because the State Department wanted to get there first. And so it sounds to me like we've got a situation where each department is worried about their own prerogatives, their own turf, and don't want to work together, and we need a comprehensive plan to get it done. And the worst thing about this, and then I'll stop, is that we requested a report 2 years ago. The report came back with similar recommendations. So what's even more frustrating than the 4 years is that nothing really has improved in the 2 years since the original report was out.
Okay, and any reason about why there haven't been changes since then?
Well, I think you get back to the lack of a comprehensive plan. You get to a point where the left hand doesn't care or know what the right hand's doing. In this case, let's say the State Department versus the Treasury Department, as an example. And just not the coordination that ought to be done when you consider what happened on September the 11th, the war on terrorists, people out to kill Americans, and the lifeblood of their operation is money coming through money laundering. And if we can cut off their lifeblood, their money, we'll probably do more good in the war on terrorism than what we're doing in Afghanistan or Iraq.
The agencies we're talking about, State Department, Treasury Department, and Justice Department?
Yes, that's right.
And if the Bush administration has said that cutting off funding to these terrorist organizations has been a priority since the September 11th attacks, what has gone wrong here?
Well, what's gone wrong is that there's not enough focus and probably not enough attention given to it by the president himself to make sure that these bureaucratic wrangling stops and that the job gets done.
So if the White House intervened, do you think that would change things?
I believe so, and I can say how frustrated I am. You know, I have jurisdiction over the Treasury Department, for instance, through my chairmanship of the Senate Finance Committee, And I brought up things like this before my committee, and each time we're promised things are going to get done. And maybe the Treasury Department's doing what it should do. Maybe the State Department's doing what they should do. But, you know, you get more bang for the buck when people are working together instead of working separately.
This report also mentions the role of private contractors drafting laws in other countries to try to stop terrorist financing. Did you know that that was happening?
No, I didn't know it was happening, but I suppose when you consider the emphasis of our own Justice Department on internal law enforcement and not so much involved with other countries, that they could probably legitimately hire lawyers to help work with legislators in other countries to get the job done. I don't have a judgment of whether that's right or wrong. I do know, though, that's one of the things that seems to have offended the Justice Department. And again, I get back to where we keep going back to. If these departments would forget about their own public relations and worry about getting the job done, the job might get done. But here you got a department that's worried about some contractor doing something instead of their own people doing it, and somehow that seems to be an excuse. That doesn't wash with me.
Mm-hmm. What countries are involved here in the report?
Well, these 27 or 29 countries, their names will not be given out because being on a priority list then tells the underworld and the money launderers and the terrorists where we're targeting our resources. So it's purposely not mentioned in the report, and it would be something that only I would get a list in a secured room.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure that the White House would say that various steps have been taken to try to stop terrorist financing, and progress is being made on some levels. Has there been some progress made here, Senator?
Well, I don't think so, and I would refer to an early morning news report that I saw just this morning, where there was the question asked of the people being interviewed. Is this a case of the money launderers and the terrorists joining up forces with the underworld to launder money to get it for their cause? And the answer there is that the terrorists are doing what our underworld people in America have been doing for years, laundering money, but they're not doing it in conjunction with them. So it seems to me that if we're this open in understanding what the problem is, and it's still a problem after 4 years, I think you can only conclude we haven't made much progress.
Mm. Is it difficult to assess that progress? It must be, because of the way that these financing schemes may or may not be carried out here. I'm wondering, does it take reports like this one for you to even be able to assess whether such things are working?
Absolutely. It is difficult, and I suppose maybe I don't have an appreciation to the departments that are involved with it, that maybe it's a bigger job than I realize, but I still know the basic behind our war on terrorism is cutting off their money supply, and if that would do it, it seems to me that's where we get more bang for the buck.
And what's the main thing that the Bush administration could do here to try to help stop the flow of money to terrorist groups?
Get all the people that work in the State Department, the Treasury Department, and the Justice Department that are involved in this effort, get them in the Oval Office and tell them, I want this squabbling to stop. You're all working for the same team. We're all working for the American people. We need to forget the turf fighting and turf protection and get the job done.
And you think that's going to happen, Senator?
No. Hmm. I'm sorry to say.
All right. Well, Senator, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You bet. Thank you.
Iowa Senator Charles Grassley is chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. He requested the report on efforts to stem the flow of money to terrorist groups. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. The science fiction notion of machines taking over the world is still with us. From Star Trek to the Terminator series movies, the idea of computers and machines eventually taking over is the premise of a new book, How to Survive a Robot Uprising, Tips on Defending Yourself Against the Coming Rebellion. And author Daniel Wilson joins us in studio to talk about the book. Welcome.
Hi, Deb.
How firmly was your tongue planted in your cheek when you wrote this?
Very firmly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the book conveys a lot of information about real robots, but I borrowed most of the robot uprising scenarios from popular culture.
Why did you decide to write this?
I've spent the last 5 years getting a degree, like a PhD in robotics, and so I was around a lot of real robots all the time. And there's a big difference between real robots and robots on TV, and the main difference is, you know, all the human killing that goes on television. And so I really wanted, you know, I sort of was initially motivated by a desire to strike back at Hollywood and say, fine, I'm going to take you seriously, but guess what? I'm actually a roboticist.
You also say in the book that in order to survive an uprising, of course, people need to make sure that they triumph over superior robotic enemies by exploiting our natural human strengths, which are robots' natural weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So is that something that you felt needed to be, maybe needed to be reiterated to people, that we actually have very strong strengths that are getting lost sometimes in the technology?
This is a huge theme in artificial intelligence. So the field of artificial intelligence initially sort of stalled out in the 60s, and the main reason was because people had this notion that what was easy for us would be easy for robots. And as it turns out, that's completely untrue. That's why a machine can beat you at chess right now, almost certainly, but it could not recognize your face. You know, probably it wouldn't be able to do that, or recognize your speech, things like that. So when we realized that, then AI started really taking on this new direction where the hardest problems to solve are the ones that we solve all the time, and that's the ones we're trying to solve now.
Mm-hmm. And when you, let's go back to Hollywood for a moment. When you watch a lot of those movies, are you what parts of them really stand out in your mind as being completely ridiculous? And at the same token, what parts stand out and you say, you know, that's pretty accurate. Somebody knew what they were talking about here.
Yeah, it's usually when things go wrong. The thing is, it's really easy to anthropomorphize robots because they look like people. They've got a lot of the same components that we have. They sort of have brains and they have, you know, arms and legs and things. And so we can kind of give them, you know, the ability to be evil. And that's pretty hard to do, actually, to make a robot that could choose to be evil. And I don't think anyone's done it yet. So when that happens, that kind of always strikes me as absurd. But whenever you see the robots walking or talking or doing all these things, there are there's tons of research trying to make that happen for real.
And what about the part of your book where the robots can assume any shape?
Yeah, so there's this idea, there's a lot of research in modular robotics where you have a robot that's composed of a lot of small identical pieces. And so each piece, sort of like a child's block, they all combine together to form one robot. And so the simplest versions right now can combine together into a chain, and then they wiggle around like a snake, and then they can recombine into maybe so that they'll have legs so they can step over an obstacle. Now, out in the future, what you might see is something like the T-1000 Terminator robot that looks like a very sexy woman by day, you know, and then converts into all these different forms, including, you know, just liquid, things like that.
So it sounds like overall, even though, you know, obviously this is very tongue-in-cheek and maybe a response to some of the fears that we've been given from Hollywood, mm-hmm. that really these machines are very sophisticated.
Yeah, and so I had to talk to lots of other roboticists to ask about their areas, you know, for humanoid robots, or could there be a giant walking robot, you know, biologically inspired robots, robots that look like flies or cockroaches or crabs or lobsters, and all the sensors that they use and everything like that. But it's all wrapped up in these uprising scenarios. So how would you trip a giant walker? How would you get out of a stranglehold if the Terminator, you know, had his meaty bicep around your neck, you know?
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Wilson is the author of How to Survive a Robot Uprising, Tips on Defending Yourself Against the Coming Rebellion. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Have you ever been asked by a foreign visitor to describe American cuisine? Hamburgers and hot dogs, you think. How about clam chowder? Cookbook author Joan Nathan went looking for American cuisine. Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst, and Joan Nathan were recently in our studio. We begin with Nathan reading from her new book, The New American Cooking.
In Clarksdale, Mississippi, the birthplace of the blues, you would hardly expect to find Chinese families speaking with a Southern drawl. But Gilroy and Sally Chow sounded like true Southerners as they chatted with me while they stir-fried collards and crayfish for supper. In the backyard, an 8-pound catfish that had been swimming in the Mississippi River that morning was steaming in the biggest wok I've ever seen. Chinese immigrants, mostly Cantonese, first came to the Delta soon after the Civil War, enticed by plantation owners eager to replace the newly freed African-American slaves. The Chow family, one of the 100 or so Chinese-American families living in Clarksdale, arrived later. My father came to Mississippi in 1912 and eventually opened a grocery store, Gilroy told me as he stirred the crawfish. Until this generation moved to Clarksdale, the Chows lived behind their grocery store in Marks, a nearby town, growing Chinese vegetables in their backyard.
Thank you, Joan Nathan. That's one of the very many wonderful stories found in your new book, The New American Cooking. This is a huge project, a virtual cross-country tour of cooking across the United States. And the first question, and probably the most obvious, is how do we define American cooking in 2005?
I don't think we can define American cuisine in one sentence. The very nature of America is changing and bringing in immigrants from all over the world. So as we bring in immigrants, we get new recipes, we get new ideas, we add them to our cooking. It has become a global cuisine in a sense because we have brought in people from everywhere and they affect our cooking. And there are just a few countries like that in the world that embrace immigration the way that we do. And I think that it's reflected in our food. So it's hard to say, you know, hamburgers, is that American cuisine? Or, grilled cheese sandwiches. Well, yeah, maybe grilled cheese sandwiches. But the grilled cheese sandwiches might be Vermont cheddar. They might have jalapenos in it. It depends on who's cooking.
Well, certainly in reading your book, it's like taking a tour. We meet all these interesting culinary characters. Some of them are Vietnamese farmers. Some of them are chefs in great restaurants, delis. Can you give us a random sampling? Tell us about maybe one of the great stories you heard on the West Coast and maybe one on the East Coast.
Well, okay, I'll tell you one wonderful story. There's a man named Ed Ledoux. And Ed Ledoux is the father of California pizza. One of the things that I try to show in American food are the great innovation that we have. This man worked on the pizza line. He was the pizza line and there was a pasta line. So he started taking pasta toppings and putting them on pizza. And a young chef from Southern California came into his restaurant, which is in Northern California, and had heard about him. This young chef was Wolfgang Puck, who was about
to open... I knew he was going to enter the story.
who was about to open a Spago, which was sort of a highfalutin pizza place. And he wanted to learn how to make pizza. So he hired this man, and the rest is history. Wolfgang Puck's made a lot of money, but Ed Ledoux was still in a little pizza place in California. Then the California Pizza Kitchen people came to him and asked him if he would be very interested in helping them. This was before they started. He helped them. He's still at Studio City. But, you know, I just was thinking about how many ideas have come out of people all around the country, and these are sort of the unsung heroes of American cuisine.
Well, you do certainly have a lot of these heroes in your book, and you find them in the most unexpected ways. How did you find these people? Was it a random sampling? Did one person lead to the next?
Yeah, one person led to the next. I told people about my quest, and they had ideas. I'll give you another example. There's a woman named Nova Kim, who was a wild mushroom forager in Vermont. Somebody sent me an email about a wild dinner that she was preparing. And so I went to Vermont and I watched her forage, and I learned so much from Nova. I always had wanted to go to the wild rice harvests in northern Minnesota. And so I visited a Chippewa Indian family and went harvesting with them, and I whacked the rice, and I watched the winnowing, the jiggering, and learned so much about wild rice, and also had a window into another community. And that was one of the most important things that I did in the book.
You talk in the book about wanting to explore, and this is your, these are your words, the positive aspects of American food today. There's certainly been a lot written about the demise of American food, the problems with pesticides, mass marketing food, fast foods. What is positive about American food today?
Oh, so much.
I'm so glad to hear that. Shed some light.
And all over the country, there are farmers that care. There are small organic companies that are growing. There are people cooking, just cooking for themselves. One of the things that I noticed tremendously as I toured the country were small restaurants by young chefs that had gone to, let's say, New York City or to the Culinary Institute, and they wanted to go back home. And they're making wonderful earthy food, not gussied up food, for themselves, their families, and those people in their neighborhood that want to come to their restaurant.
You really capture a sense of passion in the book. Everybody's stories, everyone's so passionate. They all have these smiling faces, this exuberance of dealing with a crop of lettuce or standing in front of a wok. It's a very exciting thing to read through. So I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. How does one describe an American meal? I mean, how does it differ from a Cambodian meal or a French meal? What is it? What are the elements now?
An American meal today, I think, takes the best of all of these cuisines. So we might have wraps at our house, Cambodian wraps. We were having more pho, Vietnamese stews, chicken stews, and meat stews, and they're becoming part of what we eat. But then we might have an American dessert, and we might have an American salad with them.
As you travel across the country researching the book, what surprised you?
There are two things that surprised me. One was the negative, the everydayness, the sameness of supermarkets. That really depressed me, I must tell you, that I could be in Missouri where there was strawberries growing and beautiful trout in the streams, and then you go to a supermarket and it's the same.
Yeah, and frozen and imported.
Right, exactly. But on the other hand, what really excited me was to go to different homes and see what kind of cooking there is and the tremendous growth of farmers markets and gardeners of every type trying to use fresh ingredients and learning to cook by what was available rather than going to a book first and cooking.
Which is how it all began, of
right.
course. We used our resources. We planted gardens, we harvested gardens, and we made food.
To me, that was the most exciting part.
So do you see a bright future in American food?
I do see a bright future. And I see a bright future, first of all, because of the rise of organics and the rise of the chef. Being on television, a lot of these kids who've been home alone watching television now want to get into the kitchen. I think that is encouraging.
This is fascinating to me. I know a lot of teenage boys that watch TV Food Network, and they're obsessed with it. And I think there is going to be a new generation of some very interesting chefs.
And the other thing that to me is very positive is the growth of organics. People like a guy named Steve Demos, who I interviewed, he was a vegetarian and he started stirring soy milk in the 70s. His company, which is Silk Soy, was just sold for $120 million to Dean Food. And every organic food company, small organic food company, is being bought by the conglomerates. So that it means that it's here to stay.
It's big bucks.
It's big bucks, which means that I think that it can only be encouraging for us for the future.
That's Joan Nathan talking about her book, The New American Cooking, with Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.